Hello, I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle, which is coming right up, and we have a very special program for you today. We are not in our studios, but on the road in New Orleans, where we are at the annual convention of the Edison Electric Institute. It is a tradition of this program to attend this meeting because electricity is so incredibly vital to every life, to every activity in the nation, and a steady, reliable, affordable supply of it is essential. But in the electric business, times, they are a-changing. And we're going to hear about those changes in the interviews that I'm going to bring to you from New Orleans, also quite famous, of course, for jazz, food, and sports. In the world of electric utilities, of banking, of industry in general, the name Tom Fanning is something of a legend. He is also the chairman and chief executive officer of the Giant Southern Company, one of the largest utility companies in this country. You may know it through some of its subsidiaries like Georgia Power, Mississippi Power. Give me some others.
Alabama Power, Gulf Power, Southern Power.
So you have a
Southern
a lock.
Nuclear. Yeah, we got a lot of them.
You've got a lock.
Yes, sir.
And you are a regulated utility, which for our viewers means that you get a return on equity or
return. We get a return on equity on the invested capital. We also have a very large competitive generation business, one of the largest investors in solar in the United States, all across the south half of the United States, all the way from North Carolina to California.
Now, you're director of the Federal Reserve in Atlanta.
I'm the chairman of the board of the Federal Reserve and on the executive committee of the Conference of Chairs at the Big Fed.
Which are the more interesting meetings, utility meetings or Fed meetings?
Oh, listen, they're all children in the eyes of the Lord. They're a lot of fun, every one of them.
How is Southern adapting to changes that are happening everywhere? Rooftop solar is the obvious one, but there are other things, better batteries.
Yeah, you know what I think? I think rooftop solar, distributed generation broadly, is an evolutionary thing. I don't think it is particularly disruptive. If you ever combine storage, that might be the thing that really breaks free kind of the traditional models. But so far, we're a price point away from that. Well, in terms of trying to think about what may be disruptive, one of the things we're trying to do is, I always have this concept about corporate strategy, that every element of strategy is offense and defense. So I'm trying to play offense with all these things, and the idea is to invent our future. You know, we're the only utility in America today that does robust proprietary research and development. What I've done is kind of turned on the creative juices of our employees by undertaking really a competition that will open up, I think, businesses of the future. For example, if we think about distributed generation as an investment opportunity beyond the meter, maybe we should think about a broader context of infrastructure beyond the meter. Could be distributed generation, could be storage, combined heat and power, backup generation, a whole kind of concierge service for electric transportation, a whole variety of the adaptive thermostat, the Nest thermostat. We just announced one of the biggest programs in the United States, and we're sending out adaptive thermostats from Nest. But the more interesting idea, I think, is, you know how, I used to be CIO. I always make the joke that stands for career is over. The idea of...
For our viewers and listeners, we mean Chief Information Officer.
That's right. But the more interesting idea is this. If you think about kind of control chips that are just becoming ubiquitous, every asset in your house in the not too distant future will have a control chip. Let's rethink the idea of an adaptive thermostat into something more similar to a server in your home that will connect the Internet of Things. That may be the next quantum leap in energy efficiency. So we're working on a joint venture with Nest to do that.
What does it mean for the homeowner? What is the future for the homeowner? Some people are saying because of solar panels on rooftops that electricity is going to get terribly expensive because you've lost some of your best customers. I heard actually David Owens of the Edison Electric Institute, the executive vice president, said on this program that he thought that it was a justice issue and indeed a civil rights issue.
Yeah, sure. If you do it right, there's really three elements we look for, and we participate. Starting July 1st, 2015, we will offer rooftop solar as part of our regular offerings. But three elements you got to see. Number one, this idea of net metering and a full retail charge for the electricity, that's a bad idea. You want to use something called avoided cost. That is, you get a fair payment for the present value of your capacity. The second element you look for is a fair charge for the network. The power quality out of photovoltaic solar on a rooftop is not particularly good. The network itself, not only does it give you the ability to get electrons when your solar panel isn't working, it also provides as a leveler for power quality. It has enormous value. Pay for that fairly. Third, and the obvious one is, what do you do when the sun doesn't shine? So pay for fair backup generation charges. If you get those three elements in play, it is fair and it'll work, and we're going to play offense in that realm.
You are one of two utilities building new nuclear plant.
You bet.
The Vogtle plant.
Yep.
What do the economics on that look like?
It's terrific. A lot of media, not you, but a lot of media will talk about, schedule delays and cost overruns. Did you know that for all the cost overruns that we have had with schedule changes, the benefits that we have brought to customers have been overwhelmingly in excess of the costs? In fact, when that project was approved, we thought there would be a 12% price increase. Now we believe, even with the recent cost changes, schedule changes, the price increase will have dropped from 12% to 6 to 8%. And everybody stipulates to this at Georgia. This is not a secret. It's going well. I think, Llewellyn, when Vogtle 3 and 4 is done, for the $15 billion price tag, for the 10 years to build it and design it, I think this project is going to be one of the most successful mega projects in modern industrial history.
You are into all of the new forms of generation.
Yep.
They're not all equal, are they?
No, sir.
There must be very big cost differentials.
That's right.
Which one do you like the best?
I am probably well known as the guy that's all the above. When we talk about all the above as an energy strategy, there's one company doing it, and it's Southern Company. So, leading the renaissance of new nuclear, building out 21st century coal. We got a coal technology we're starting up right now in Mississippi. Emits less carbon than natural gas. Also produces more domestic oil. Imagine that, using a resource that otherwise goes unused, we're going to produce electricity cleaner than natural gas and produce more domestic oil. Tax base, jobs, it's win-win-win. Enormous shift away from coal to natural gas. We've done that. Before I took this job, we produced about 70% of our energy from coal. Now it's down to, we think this year, about 32. Before I came here, 16% from natural gas, now about 48%. And moving that way. Renewables, we're one of the biggest investors of solar. Doing a little bit in wind. I'm not a particular fan of wind. Sorry for the pun. Get it? Fan of wind. And then energy efficiency.
I'm not a big fan of wind either.
Well, it's great in some places. It doesn't make sense so much in the southeast.
Well, you don't have a lot of wind resources.
That's it. That's it.
You know, the months when you want it, when you want the electricity, July and August, are hot and sticky because there's no wind.
You got it. Yeah.
It also takes up a lot of land.
Well, so does solar. And in fact, I had a great annual meeting. It went 2.5 hours on questions, all very constructive and friendly. But one of the points that we really thought about, I know solar feels green, right? But from a land use standpoint, it is awfully land intensive. To produce 1 megawatt of solar requires 7 acres of land. And so, you know, there's going to be this pushback, inexorably, I think, where when we think about wind and solar from a land use standpoint, right now it feels almost free. It is not free. And we've always got to have a balance. So when you say, what's my favorite? I love nuclear, I love 21st century coal, natural gas, renewables, and energy efficiency.
Do your stockholders love you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know.
And how are you going to keep growing so they continue to love you?
oh, listen, you know, I think the infrastructure of the future, so EPA is coming out with this 111D proposal. That will require a further transition in the generating fleet of America. We are uniquely poised to do that in a carbon-friendly way, probably than any other utility in the United States. So look for that. Look for continued penetration in renewables. Watch out now as we move to more gas. One of the failings of the proposed rule 111D is they think by 2020 we're going to be able to make another big shift to gas. There's not enough gas infrastructure in the form of pipelines. Maybe we get in that.
For the public's benefit, what is 11D?
Oh, 111D, I'm sorry, thank you. 111D is the Clean Power Plan, which is EPA's way of putting in place a regime that will likely have as a consequence emitting less carbon from an electric generating resource.
Tom Fanning, you're a very exciting man.
Oh no,
thank
it's always
so
a pleasure.
Thank
Good
you so
seeing
very
you.
Much.
Yes, sir, thank you.
A short pause for station identification, primarily for our listeners on Sirius XM Radio, channel 124, the POTUS channel. This is White House Chronicle. I am Llewellyn King, and we're coming to you today from the Edison Electric Institute annual meeting in New Orleans, Louisiana. This program can be seen around the world on the English language stations of the Voice of America and on 200 select American television screens. Barry Worthington is Executive Director of the United States Energy Association and as such has an extraordinarily broad view of energy developments. What brings you to the Edison Electric Institute meeting?
Well, I think it's important to come to this every year because it's one way to make sure that you're still in touch with the trends in the industry. The industry is changing rather quickly, and from one year to the next, it's kind of remarkable how you see trends shifting around. In one funny sort of way of looking at it, I almost hope I don't learn anything new, because that means I'm missing something. And coming here and making certain that I'm current with everything that's going on in the industry is very, very valuable.
Change is in the wind, change for everything. You and I have seen phenomenal changes in the supply of gas, the supply of oil, the fortunes of coal, and now the electric utility industry is convulsed almost by change.
Well, and no one knows where we're going to end up, but there's a lot of new players, there's a lot of new people who want to get into the business. That you would have even thought about 5 or 10 years ago. And it's hard to imagine how it's going to change over the next 5 or 10 years.
Difficult to imagine that it won't be seriously impacted by the arrival of companies like Google and the great solar company, SolarCity, headed by Elon Musk, the big battery guru.
Well, that's true, but I will say it's a huge industry. In the United States, our power industry is gigantic, 1 million megawatts plus of generating capacity. And as much as change is in the air, it's still a bit like a big old ship that turns quite slowly just because of its size.
What does this change that's taking place, we're not quite sure where it ends, but that is taking place, mean for the consumer? The person in their apartment or in their home, what does it mean? What does it mean in cost, reliability, and also how much data is now being collected on the consumer? I hear here a lot of reference to getting to know the customers, which it's taken them a while to think that, perhaps, but that's very much the idea here at the Edison Electric Institute.
Well, that's what you're hearing now, and what's remarkable if you step back and think about it, an electric utility went from having 12 pieces of information a year about their customer, one meter reading a month. Now they have 96 per day. From 12 a month to 96 per day. That's rather remarkable.
This is the so-called smart grid?
The smart meters, which smart is part of the smart grid. And it's a little bit uneven because, you know, it's not real clear yet just what exactly you can do with all this data. And on the one hand, it's kind of terrifying because of the unknown. On the other hand, it's exciting because it's dynamic and you're going to see significant changes going on. It's not clear yet who's going to be the winner when it's all over and done with. Will the traditional, historic, incumbent utility become nimble and be able to retain their customers and retain their business model? Or will new entrants in the field upset the apple cart and just cause all kinds of chaos and destruction to current long-standing business models?
At this exhibition behind me is an engine, an electric conversion for a truck, which can then run on electricity and diesel, a hybrid. We've heard a lot, particularly from Elon Musk, who heads Tesla Motors, as well as Solar City, and also SpaceX, one of the great creative minds of our time, talking about electrification and transportation almost as though it were here today. How fast is it going to get here?
Well, I think it's going to be a little bit slower than what some would imagine, because the typical automobile driver, their first priority is still convenience. And all the survey data still shows that the gasoline customer stops at the right at a gas station that's on their right-hand side on their way going home from work. They won't make a left turn to save a nickel on gasoline. It's got to be more than that. So electric vehicles are going to have to match the convenience of gasoline before they're really, really going to take off. If they can get that achievement, then the sky's the limit. But they're going to have to compete for convenience. And I don't think it's quite there yet.
It might be said that batteries, because they can help rooftop solar installations, 24 hours eventually, the batteries are the enemy, but they're also the friend of utilities, because for the first time ever they can contemplate storing large amounts of electricity in batteries.
Yes, if you can get to that is the key, what you just said, it's large amounts. And, the death of the traditional utility may be overstated, because while storage can facilitate wind and solar and other intermittent supplies of electricity, it also can make old coal plants more valuable. Coal plants generate electricity very, very cheaply overnight when there's low peak demand. And you actually may see battery technology being the savior of keeping coal plants economical.
Talking about coal, a lot of people think it's the sole contributor to global warming, or climate change, as people might prefer to call it. But it also is the great friend of the utility industry. And recently, I've heard there are better ways of burning it and a move to capture the carbon dioxide, the bad gas, and store it, so-called carbon capture and storage. Maybe you'd tell us about developments in both better combustion and the future of capturing the pollutant.
Well, it's possible, very possible, to improve the efficiency of existing coal plants. And research has shown that a 2% improvement in efficiency causes a 5% reduction in CO2 emissions. So if you're able to improve efficiency substantially, you can achieve a 20-25% reduction in CO2 from existing plants. Then the technology is being demonstrated today to capture CO2 from coal plants and store underground, and particularly to store the CO2 in old oil fields to produce additional supplies of petroleum and natural gas, for that matter. Enhanced oil recovery assets.
You're a global traveler. What exciting things are happening outside of the U.S., and can we learn from them?
Well, we certainly can. We can learn about the experience the Germans have with deploying solar and wind, where electricity costs 4 to 5 times in Germany what it costs in the United States. Our average price of electricity is about 12 cents a kilowatt hour in the United States. In Germany, it's between 40 and 50 cents. So we can learn from their experience in moving too quickly, with solar and wind in a climate where it's not ideal and having significantly increasing prices. We can learn in Asia about deploying new nuclear plants. Nuclear plants are being built in China, they're being built in Korea, they're going to be built in parts of the Mideast. We can learn from China in a number of ways. China may actually beat the United States to demonstrating carbon capture and storage. They have several projects underway, and they may gain that experience, and we may be learning from the Chinese.
Likewise in nuclear, they are surging ahead with nuclear
development. Absolutely.
Not much future here for nuclear at present?
Well, the future for nuclear is going to be very, very difficult as long as our domestic supplies of natural gas are abundant and inexpensive. People think of the Fukushima accident as delaying the nuclear renaissance in the United States. I think it's more so the price of natural gas. When natural gas is as plentiful and as inexpensive as it is, it's very easy for a power developer to simply make the easy choice of building a natural gas unit.
Barry Worthington, wise man of energy.
Well,
thank you so
good
much.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Rod Kukrow is one of the most respected and best energy reporters in Washington. He writes for an organization called E&E Publishing. Rod, welcome to the broadcast. You've been looking at the energy industry for a long time, at electricity in particular. Suddenly it's shifting. It was very static and now it's moving. What's going on?
I like the fact you use the word static. That's a nice pun on what's been going on in the industry. Now it's a dynamic change going on, Llewellyn. We've talked about this before, but in the past year since we last spoke on your program, so much more has happened than I think would have been predicted. What I'm talking about chiefly is the acceleration of utility adoption and acceptance of renewable energy as a serious investment. There are a couple examples of that. One is the price. The price of the technologies, both wind turbines and solar panels, have come down at a rate that no one could have predicted 5 or 10 years ago, to the point where utilities are now, their first choice when they build new generation is not a coal plant, obviously, or even a gas plant. It's a renewable energy facility. One reason is the fuel is free. The fuel is free forever. And it's dawning upon companies like Southern Company and others in that large sphere of integrated utilities that operate in multiple states that they can sign 20 or 30 year agreements for power at prices that are unheard of from, say, a fossil fuel plant. Just recently in Georgia, a power purchase agreement was approved for a large utility scale solar farm for 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Now, the average rate paid in America for a kilowatt hour by residential customer is about 11 or 12 cents. So they're buying that power at half the retail rate. They can't do that with a plant where they have to actually go out and buy the coal or buy the natural gas because these plants have no fuel costs. But the other great breakthrough has been that Southern Company, who I mentioned already, did something rather groundbreaking about 2 weeks ago. At their annual meeting, their CEO, Tom Fanning, announced that Georgia Power, an electric utility, was going to throw down the gauntlet to the companies that have been doing solar power, third-party solar like SolarCity and First Solar and Sunrun, and he was going to do that business himself. In other words, if one of his customers, residential customer, wants to have rooftop solar, he's going to sell them a panel. And beginning July 1st, that business will be live for Georgia Power.
That seems a self-obvious solution. Why didn't the utilities take that route earlier? They wouldn't have the problem with these competitors.
Well, I think it's fear. I mean, there's no doubt that in the states where some companies like SolarCity are allowed to operate, and they're not allowed to operate in most states by state law, they have been taking away market share from utilities. And I think executives have seen that, and they've just been scared, unwilling to think about the potential of what if I do that myself. The reality is that most people who put rooftop solar on their home don't do it to try to provide 100% of their power. They don't want to be an island. They do it for all kinds of reasons. They want to be green. They want to cut down the carbon footprint. Maybe they want to even save some money, but they tend to maybe take half their power from the sun or a wind turbine and the rest from the utility. The sweet spot for the utility that gets into the solar business has to be, how do we adjust our rates so we continue to make enough money to pay for the maintenance of the grid for all those people who have no solar power? And that's part of the debate going on right now in the industry, is what's the price point?
Companies like Sun City have been joined by Google. Google is a name that conjures all kinds of expertise, resources. What is Google doing in the electric space?
Well, one thing Google's doing, along with some other very large users of internet capacity like Facebook, is they're building large data centers. More and more, of course, as they get more customers and they offer more services, they're saving a lot of your data, your photographs, your music, your conversations with your friends and family. And they're building data centers all over the United States to house that information. And they have chosen the path where they're willing to pay a premium for their electricity so that those data centers are powered by sun or wind when possible. So they are driving that trend. And it's no surprise that these utilities, when they see the most successful companies in America, so those with the highest stock prices, the most attraction to Wall Street, saying, we're willing to pay a premium for our power because we want it to come from the sun, because we care about carbon. That's a wake-up call to the utilities.
That is the value added that they can offer, is that it's green. Once upon a time, I ran a conference on value added in electric utilities, and the only thing they really came up with, and there wasn't much of it in those days, was environmentally friendly generation, green. Why don't they include nuclear in that?
Well, that's such a much larger policy issue, because there's still lingering doubts, as you know, in this country about the aftermath of Three Mile Island. But the fact is, we've operated safely for all that those 40 years since. The environmental community still refuses to embrace nuclear power as being green, even though it's carbon-free. I think that'll play out, though, in the next few months, and we see what the administration does with this clean power plan, where they're going to give nuclear plants more of a leg to stand on. But there's one thing I wanted to tell you about that maybe isn't self-evident to most consumers in America. What the utilities are doing now with their business is they're trying to not just sell you electricity. They want to sell you things like solar panels, like backup generation devices. They want to sell you a Nest thermostat if they can, home energy management systems. And they're getting back in the business they were in at their inception, back when Edison started the utilities. They're selling products. Most people don't realize, because we weren't around then, only our grandparents were, but people would go to a store run by the Edison company to buy a washing machine or a refrigerator or electric iron or lamps, because it was those devices that let you buy electricity. If those of you didn't have this in your home, you weren't a customer. So in some ways, it's a back to the future.
Radio did the same thing.
Yes.
You had to buy a radio in order to listen to the radio, and the people who provided the signal sold you the radio.
So I think some of the forward-looking utilities realize that they can sell just not the electrons over the wire, but they're going to sell you things that will make you use more electrons or use those electrons more efficiently.
Is this revolution good for the consumer or not?
It's great for the consumer long term. I mean, the fact is, every time you buy anything new, whether it's a personal appliance or something large like an HVAC system for your home or your business, every single generation of that is more efficient. I spoke this morning with Secretary Moniz, the Secretary of Energy, and he was noting that just last year, DOE, his department, had 10 rulemakings related to efficiency of products, mundane products, hot water heaters, washing machines. All of these things now in the future will be more efficient. So they will cost people less money to run over the long term.
Ron, you're a very wise man. It's a pleasure to have you on the board.
Thank you. Well, it's good to be here.
So there you have it, a look at the future of electricity and how it affects you. And don't forget, there's nothing in your daily life that you do, from this to the television set you're watching me on, that is not powered by electricity. One of the great, amazing boons to the human race. See you next week on the same stations at the same time. Cheers.